is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Today we'll take you out on farm where hay's being cut to look at the rapidly drying season in north and northwest Victoria. How's your season going? If you're out on farm and want to send us a photo of your crops or the hay that you're cutting at the moment, I'd love to see them. 0467 842 722 to send a text. You can also call with an update, 1300 977 222. Hey shearers, fancy a sheep delivery system?
So it actually grabs the sheep and slides the sheep out and then sits it right up on its backside and right where you want to start shearing.
We're going to learn about that system today. Plus, we have the details of a few sheep price records in today's Rural Muster. And we get an update from Gordon, the five-year-old who asked farmers for help to add to his ear tag collection.
And where else do they come from, mate? What other states?
Queensland. And I have one from Ireland and Canada.
Did you get one from Canada?
Yeah.
Oh, can't wait for that one. This is the Country Hour. Thanks for making us part of your day.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Let's start today, though, by heading out on farm on the Country Hour. Eden Henninen is our reporter out on the road today. Eden, welcome. Where are you?
Thanks, Woz. That's right. I'm in the small town of Prairie in northern Victoria. That's just north of Bendigo. And I must say, driving up through central Victoria this morning, it was pretty cloudy and overcast, but we're quite lucky here at the moment. Despite the wind that you might be hearing in the background there, the weather's opened up. It's sunny. So it's great to be out before the weather changes over the next week. And I'm here with Russell Hocking at his property where he's just started cutting his hay. Russell, welcome to the program. How's it all going at the moment?
At the moment it's going okay. We've cut some vetch and we're starting to cut oats shortly. The yields are looking somewhere like average, so yeah, going quite well.
What is that yield? Do you have an idea yet?
The oats are looking around the 5 tonne to the hectare. Vetch, maybe 3 tonne to the hectare, so round about average.
How does that compare, say, to last year?
Similar yields, perhaps not quite as good as last year, but we're really hoping for better quality than last year.
And we're not in the mower at the moment. Things have kind of ceased here today. Where are you up to? Has it just kind of started to kick off? You're waiting for the next paddocks to be ready?
Yes, here at Prairie, it's just a little bit too early. We've done a little bit. Further north and west into the Mallee, I'm sure the mowers are all very busy. There's a lot of vetch being cut. And the oats will be starting soon or have already started. So, yeah, we're just at the very beginning.
And what about rainfall-wise? How has that been here for you over the past few months?
So we're probably, you know, somewhere around average rain, perhaps a little bit less. We haven't had enough. We had a very dry start, like everyone else. The bit in the middle was quite good. And at the end, we're running out of moisture rapidly.
And you also grow some other grain crops here. How's that going?
They're really, they're looking quite good. We're on track for average or possibly better with rain, but without rain they'll drop below average. So we're really on the knife's edge at the minute. We need rain reasonably desperately.
How do you balance that with wanting to cut your hay and then also for your grain crops?
Well, you've got to be sort of glass half full. So,
are you there at the moment?
I can be half full or half empty, depends on the day. But yeah, look, we just deal with whatever happens. If we got 20 mil, that'd be fantastic, especially in the next week, because there wouldn't be a lot of hay cut, and that would have an enormous benefit. Either way, I'm a winner or I'm not a winner. Depends on how you feel on the day.
There's some predicted frost coming for Sunday and Monday. Is that a concern for your grain?
Look, a little bit, but in our area, frost really isn't a big issue. We very rarely have problems with frost, but I'm certain there'd be people in other areas that will be monitoring that closely.
Russell, you spoke to the Country Hour. It would have been a few months ago before sowing. You said that you wouldn't pull back this year despite the loss of the Chinese market with your export hay. Was that the right decision?
Well, we're not going to know that until we get the hay baled. At the minute, I'm still quite hopeful it will be, but we really need to grow or to bale good quality oats. If we get more weather damage on the oats, I'd have some serious concerns that that was the right decision, but we don't know.
So that's, like you said, that balancing act at the moment to get rain for your grain, but then also the issue with getting too much rain on the hay.
Yeah, too much rain in the hay. I really don't want to think about that on export hay because it's going to cause, I would imagine, some major headaches for growers and more so for exporters.
Have you spoken to exporters about where things are at the moment?
Yeah, we sort of try and keep in touch with the ones we deal with to see how things are progressing, and I would imagine they are exactly like me, really got their fingers crossed for good quality hay.
What about with shipping and access to containers?
This is like a major issue for ag in general, that there's just not containers available to get, and if you can get containers, it's a real struggle to find a ship to put them on. Things like ships that are booked not even turning up in port is happening. So what that means at the end is the shipping cost have doubled or tripled, and all that eventually gets passed on to us, the growers.
So the loss of the Chinese market, increased shipping costs, is that viable in the next few seasons to be exporting hay?
That's an interesting question. We'll know a lot more in a month, but I'm certain a lot of people will be asking the same question when they're doing their sowing programs next year. That will be front of mind for any sort of people that are into the export oats.
But in the meantime, just take it day by day and be that glass half full, as you said, with hopefully some good weather coming over the next week, at least for grain.
Yeah, that's right. Fingers crossed. Hopefully we can have some really good hay and some good grain. That'd be ideal.
Russell Hocking, thanks for joining the program.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Back to you, Woz.
Thanks very much for that, Eden. Eden Hennan there, our reporter, Bendigo Rural reporter out in the paddocks at Prairie, as you've just heard, with how the hay crop is being cut there and what the season's looking like. Love you to send us a text and tell us what it's looking like where you are, or you can call us indeed, 1300 977 222 to call on the text line on 0467 842 722. We have a few messages coming in. Doggy, the dairy farmer at Corimba, has sent a photo looking out the front window of the tractor going down rows of cut hay there. Looking lovely and green, I must say, Doggy. Thank you very much for that. Margot has sent a photo, beautifully styled photo of a wheat crop there, Margot, saying they're looking amazing at Naring, which is sort of east of Numurkah, I suppose you'd say that. Northern Victoria, looking beautiful there. Sadly, it's not the same for everyone. Bob at Werrimal has sent us a photo. You've got the rolling hill in the background, actually, and the hill looks a bit patchwork. You see the yellowing area, some browning area, as well as the interspersed amongst some green too. So the crop doesn't look good there. And he said almost dead if we don't get a lot more rain very soon at Werrimal, says Bob at Werrimal. You can send your text in. Send us a photo if you've got one, like Margot and Doggy and Bob have. 0467 842 722. Whilst we're talking about a season where there's been, more rain for some, not everyone like Bob, there's a lot more water in the river system, though, particularly around southeastern Australia, which means there's one more pest landowners need to look out for, and that's carp. Over the past 5 years, a program of volunteers have helped to pull, get this, 16.95 tonnes of carp from the Ovens and King Rivers, local wetlands and private dams. They have worked in partnership with DELP's Arthur Ryler Institute for Environmental Research and the Northeast Catchment Management Authority. Annie Brown spoke with Kelvin Berry, a volunteer for the Wangaratta Land Care and Sustainability Network, and started by asking how carp were getting into farmers' dams.
Various ways, from flood situations, like we've got now, we get major floods that are in there, but one of the things that people have a problem understanding is that the birds that get in where carp spawn and that the eggs are going to get on their legs, and then they go somewhere else, and the eggs are still there, and then they hatch out in dams and that.
Why do you need to take the carp out of the dams? What sort of damage are they doing?
Some of these bigger dams, it's very difficult to remove them, and they become a real problem because they contaminate the water to such a state that the stock won't drink out of them. riparian effect. They're bottom feeders, and everyone's most people are aware of that. Then they shovel feed on the bottom, and they stir up the turbulence in the water. Is bloody incredible when they get going. When we done the Mulwala Weir, we done a project the last time. There was a drawdown of the lake, and the Arthur Otter boys have been about a bit. And when we were electrofishing some areas there, they said it's the worst that they've seen the damage of carp have done in the lower ovens area there, upstream from the junction. And they just decimate the vegetation and habitat for native fish where they spawn and breed and hang out. And then the damage they do is incredible.
And so, yeah, what are you seeing now over the 6 years? Are you seeing an improvement at least?
Look, I'm sort of not allowed to quote some of these figures, but I can give you a bit of an idea that the work that we've done specifically in the Ovens River, biomass of carp, we've reduced it from 85 to 90% to probably about 35 to 40%. The evidence that I can quote on that is that the Arthur Otter guys, they've got ongoing projects, and they use an electrofishing method. And the sites that they do is, say, from Gapstead to Burriman, so there's, you know, say 15 sites that they do, and they do them on a regular basis. So you can classify it as data because it's been over a 10-year period. And the population figures that we've got to start with when I started with them to what they are now is the fact that the carp numbers are reduced. There's no juvenile carp in the system in that area. And the native fish numbers, trout cod, Murray cod, yellow bellhead, have increased incredibly. And the Macquarie Perch Project, we've released over 100,000 Macquarie Perch from various sources into the Ovens River system, and they have become self-sustainable since we started putting them in there. And that's all due to the removal of carp and taking them out of the system.
Wow, that's an incredible result. How did you get involved in all this?
A situation where the Arthur Roller Institute were doing a demonstration of the Ovens and King River system with their electrofishing unit. And they got some carp, and they caught them, and then they released them. And I said, what are you doing? You blokes are supposed to be showing the way, and you put them back. And they said, we haven't got the resources or the manpower to take them out and do something with. So that evolved in forming a partnership with our network with the Arthur Otter boys, and it's been a fantastic relationship with these guys. And I done some work, groundwork, and when they come back and we start to get the carp, we formed a partnership with Nutrisoil. They're a chemical-free fertiliser company in Wodonga. They put the carp into compost heaps, and then the worms eat the carp, and then they use the urine to produce chemical-free fertiliser. So it completes a wonderful cycle. You're removing a pest species out of our waterways, wetlands, and they're utilising them and in their product. So that's been a win-win and a good news story.
That's Kelvin Berry, volunteer from Wangaratta Land Care and Sustainability Network, who's passionate about catching carp. Speaking there to Annie Brown. You're listening to The Country Hour. It is 19 past 12. Shearers, this one's for you. It's known as the catch and drag, the process where a shearer catches and tips over the sheep, drags it onto the board for shearing. And it's considered to be the part of the shearing process that's the most inefficient and poses the greatest risk of injury. That's why Australian Wool Innovation is developing a mechanical system that delivers the sheep to the shearer, eliminating the catch and drag. Former world champion shearer Shannon Warnes, who came up with the initial concept, says shearing needs to become less laborious.
A lot of the injuries happen in getting the sheep out on the board in the catching pen, and, you know, I think some of the figures are around 70% of injuries. So, you know, that's one of the main objects of the catch and drag system. And then also, you know, while that sheep's being delivered to you, you can, you know, have a drink, have a stretch. So, you know, it's more for your body as well. See, you know, a really good shearer can shear well in excess of 200 growing sheep. Well, some of the growing sheep these days are, you know, 80, 90 kilos. So you start doing your mass, all of a sudden there's 20 tonne of meat you've got to drag. And, you know, the average catch and pen might be 6 or 7 metres deep. So, you know, if you had 20 ton of gravel and I'll give you a shovel, I reckon that wouldn't be real much fun shoveling it. So to get these sheep to the delivered to the shearer right at the right spot is ideal.
Okay, so reduce the risk of injury, reduce time, and especially save energy.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And then your longevity of shearers in the industry, like if we can save your body, well, you know, they can get a few more years out of them.
Shannon, just describe it for me, because maybe it is a little hard to visualise, but try and describe for me how it actually works and what it looks like.
So, yeah, earlier on we were looking at it, and there's a race that comes behind you, just like a normal crutching trailer. But we went down to the concept of using pneumatics, which is air-operated, and a lot of the cattle, like sale yards, use them now. And so it actually grabs the sheep and slides the sheep out and then sits it right up on its backside and right where you want to start shearing. So the other thing I really like about it is, you know, the sheep are quite calm in there rather than, you know, manually go in there and tip the sheep over and drag the sheep out. It's a lot more animal friendly as well, and we've done a couple of days with it, and we're just finding the sheep are coming out with a lot less stress as well. So, you know, less stress on the sheep, less stress on the shearer, so it's coming together.
Right, so this wouldn't work in with catching pens. There would be a race running along behind the board that would replace those catching pens.
Yeah, it's a module, so you'd buy the whole setup, and if you want 1, 2, 3, 4, it all hooked together. And then the other thing we really liked about it, and it was a project with AWI earlier on, was, you know, a lot of the traditional crutching shearing trailers, when the sheep gets released, it shoots off past the wool handler, which is a bit of a danger. So we've designed it that the sheep go back underneath the race out behind the plant, so there's no danger of anyone getting injured.
Right, so there's this clamp, I suppose, that clamps the sheep, flips the sheep on its back, and then deposits the sheep in front of the shearer, almost in the position where it needs to be for shearing?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And then all you do is grab the sheep and put the leg behind for the start of the belly position, and away you go. And that clamp returns back to the original position, and then a gate comes open behind your shearing stand to let the next sheep into the clamps.
And I imagine then, Shannon, that you'd need someone sort of pushing up the whole time. Is that how the concept would work?
Yeah, the concept's got a race, a walking race behind the actual shearing race. So, you know, you still need a penner-upper.
So do you see it being retrofitted to existing shearing sheds or being used in new setups or temporary setups?
Yeah, all of the above, really, where we could use it. Like, obviously, if someone spent a lot of money on a new shearing shed, they're not going to pull it to bits and put these systems in. But, you know, for someone that's got a lot of, you know, odd blocks around, like you could buy one or two or three, you know, they could fit on the truck or, you know, we could make a trailer that you could tow it around with it as well. And, you know, I think they're sort of talking it might be about $18,000 a module where we end up with it. So, you know, these days to fit out a four-stand shearing shed, like just as a bit of a stab, you're probably looking at $200,000 where, you know, for a farmer that does a lot of cropping and doesn't want to spend that big infrastructure, well, you could have a implement shed where these machines could be up along the back wall. And then you could stack them out the way to put your tractors back, and all you really need is a power and an air compressor, and away you go.
That is shearer Shannon Warnus, one of those working with Australian Wool Innovation on the Modular Sheep Delivery Unit project. Terrible name, really interesting work, though. I wonder what that would do to your life as a shearer. You can always let us know. Speaking there, obviously, with Angus Verley, I remember interviewing Shannon Warnus when he was world champion shearer as well. Very, very good at his craft. Interesting seeing people like that passionate about changing the mechanics of the industry. On the text line on 0467 842 722, John says, "G'day, Woz. This is a paddock of annual ryegrass finishing off our EU feeder steers before sending them off at around 500 kilograms to the feedlot. We're at Mum Benar. I probably butchered that one. Sorry, John, in southwest Victoria, not far from the SA border. Tell you what, my pronunciation of the town might be terrible. The paddock looks an absolute treat. Really thick. lush grass sitting there. Keep them coming. Love to see whether it's hay being cut, whether it's paddock of grass or crops. Love seeing your photos coming in today. Let us know how you're going. 0467 842 722. And while we're talking about hay being cut and how the season's going, it's probably a good chance to have a warning. The CFA is warning farmers to exercise caution when cutting, baling and storing hay ahead of the upcoming fire season, especially with some strong seasonal conditions in areas increasing fuel and allowing for potential fires. The most recent seasonal outlook for spring by the Australasian Fire and Emergency Service Authorities Council shows that average to above average rainfall is expected to promote strong vegetation growth across the state during spring. Chief Officer Jason Heffernan says haystack fires can start quite easily from lightning strikes or sparks from equipment and machinery, but a major source of ignition is spontaneous combustion of hay bales themselves.
Predictions of a strong hay season makes it extremely important that farmers take care when cutting, baling and storing hay for fire prevention and, most importantly, for their own good returns. Our message to farmers across Victoria is to make sure that you need to exercise caution when cutting and baling hay and storing hay to prevent those fires from starting and putting at risk what is expected to be a really good hay season. If not monitored, haystacks pose a real risk to fire igniting and spreading across farmlands in Victoria, and that's certainly what we don't want to see.
So is there any particular region in Victoria that's a particularly high risk this year?
And it doesn't matter where you are in terms of the pastures that you grow and that you bale. As many of our farmers would know, it's all about that moisture content, and cutting and conditioning and baling your hay at the wrong time or stacking it too early leads to that buildup of heat and then obviously the spontaneous combustion coming through. So our farmers are very experienced here in Victoria. They've been doing this for generations. But what we want to do is just serve as a bit of a timely reminder. As I said, those hay prices are quite high. The demand for hay across the regions is quite high, particularly having those interstate pressures. So we want to make sure that our farmers have a bumper season and that they're not adversely affected by hay fires.
And I suppose prior to the haystacks being a problem, obviously harvest can also pose some fire risks. What's your message to farmers in regards to when they're harvesting their fodder this year?
If it's not haystack fires, it's harvesting, I guess, is probably two of the main areas of concern for fire services at this time of year. And when it comes to harvest, it's about making sure that we got that harvest machinery serviced, that it's checked, that it's able to work effectively and is operating appropriately. We don't want to see fires start as a result of faulty machinery or poorly maintained machinery that puts at risk some really good returns. And I know our farmers have been struggling for the last couple of years, so we want to see that they get the best out of this harvest season.
There has been some supply chain issues in regards to people being able to access, for example, new machinery. Is the CFA concerned that there might be excess older machinery out on paddocks this year?
One of the things from my perspective that I am giving some consideration is because of the challenges in supply, whether it be for supply of new machinery or supply of contractors, may lead farmers to pull out that old piece of machinery out of the shed and bring it back into life, which is entirely appropriate and good for what they need to do. But what we want to do is make sure that it's serviceable. So if you are going to get the old harvester out, make sure that you have it serviced, that it is in good running order, and that it's not likely to start a fire on you and put at risk the hard-earned income from cropping.
What are some tips for farmers in stacking and storing hay this year?
Many farmers out there would have their own way of checking and storing it. My grandfather showed me that the best way is that either a probe or a thermometer or even the old crowbar through some of the haystacks there, checking that temperature, making sure that it's not too hot to the touch. And some of the rule of thumb, yeah, less than 50 degrees, you know, you can handle the bar without discomfort. You should be checking those temperatures daily. Anything between 50 to 60 degrees, you can hold onto the crowbar for a short period of time. And then anything over 70 degrees, the bar's just too hot to touch. And that's where you're really in that dangerous territory. And if you do get a haystack and that is the case, you need to pull it apart pretty quickly. Otherwise, you're at real risk of having a spontaneous combustion and a fire. What I do implore our farmers to do is just stop. Take a couple of minutes to think about how you're preparing for this season. What do you need to do to get ready, whether it be checking your equipment, making sure that you've got that tank and pump and fire extinguishers on hand, thinking about your fire breaks, where they might be, your stock rotations and those sort of things. Just spending a couple of minutes could be the difference between getting burnt out and not this summer.
There you go. That's CFA Chief Officer Jason Heffernan speaking there with Jane McNaughton on the text line. Someone says, we built this. Oh, this is in to do with the sheep delivery system we're just hearing about on the Country Out to make life easier for shearers. It says, we built this system in 1996. And this is what's wrong with the wool industry. It keeps reinventing the wheel. Progress is slow, but take your point. Thank you very much for sending that through. Let's head to the newsroom now to find out what's happening around our state. Rio Davis is in the newsroom for us today. Hi, Rio.
G'day, Warwick. Making news across the regions, a Broken Hill man with COVID-19 has died at the local hospital. The Far West Local Health District says the man, aged in his 50s, is the first person to die with the coronavirus in the area since the pandemic began. He was unvaccinated and had underlying health conditions. The man was a close contact of a previously confirmed case. Victoria has recorded 733 cases of COVID-19 overnight, with 27 in regional Victoria. Albury-Wodonga Health has confirmed there are 3 new cases of COVID-19 in Wodonga. One case is a close contact of a COVID-positive person from outside the region. The 2 other cases are close contacts of the first, and contact tracing is underway. Across the border, another case has also been detected for a total of 5 in the Albury local government area. Victorians in an extreme risk zone in New South Wales and the ACT will be eligible to return home from next Thursday if they are fully vaccinated. Conditions include having a negative COVID-19 test 72 hours before their departure, quarantining at home for 14 days upon arrival, and getting tested again at the start and the end of their quarantine period. The current extreme risk zone rules will remain for Victorians who aren't fully vaccinated. A leading Western Victorian pharmacist says this week's arrival of the Moderna coronavirus vaccine will provide a significant boost to regional Victoria's vaccination rate. More than 300,000 Moderna vaccines will be distributed to 721 pharmacies across Victoria this month. Head pharmacist Peter Fowles says regional and remote vaccination rates will increase significantly once Moderna is readily available. And a coronial inquiry has heard the bushfire, which threatened 10,000 holidaymakers in Mallacoota, could have been extinguished if aerial resources had been available. Witnesses told the New South Wales Bushfires Coronial Inquiry that the Banana Track border fire, which started at the end of December in 2019, was only accessible by air. Fire authorities say the nation's aerial firefighting resources were already at capacity in New South Wales. For more regional news at any time, you can visit abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Rio. Rio Davis there with regional news headlines.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
We have the rural muster coming up on the program today too. Stay tuned for that. Some sheep price records again. Feels like we have a couple of them every week at the moment, but some more coming up in Rural Muster for you today. I have been asking you to send us a photo if you're out harvesting, cutting your hay, or if you're out looking at your crops, inspecting things there, or just sending us a great paddock of grass like John did earlier. You can send it through 0467 842 722. While we're at it, someone sent this great one. It's a little video. Nice sunny day for pruning citrus in Sunraysia, it says. Have a listen to this. So we've got a look from inside an excavator or a tractor cab with a bit of mesh over the front, and you see this slicer, automatic slicer, over the top of all these beautiful neon green citrus trees, and every now and then you see a branch come down. It's absolutely spectacular. Whoever you are, thank you very much for sending that through from Sunraysia. Beautiful day for pruning citrus, apparently, up that way at the moment. 0467 842 722 if you'd like to send us a text of what you're doing today. Let's find out what's happening weather-wise around the state of Victoria right now and, you know, just on the other side of the borders in a few different directions as well. Matthew Thomas is a senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. You can join us on the line again today. G'day, Matthew.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Beautiful day for pruning citrus in Sunraysia, and it's pretty sunny in a lot of other points around Victoria at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, certainly north of the divide, it's
that's mostly sunny. A little bit of cloud just sort of pushing onto the divide and just sort of the northern slopes. But we do have a front crossing the state at the moment, and it is bringing more of a westerly change. Most of the rainfall that we've seen has been about the southwest or the down into west and south Gippsland. So we're looking at, you know, since 9 a.m. we've seen 7 millimetres down at Wilson's Prom and 4 millimetres at Yanaki, but into the southwest there's been a couple of millimetres about the southwest. And so, you know, I think 3 millimetres at Mount William has been the highest out in the southwest, but very little elsewhere. And really for today, that's going to be the story of the day. We do have that front crossing. There's some quite cold air pushing to our south over Tasmania, and that's going to impact on and south of the divide with scattered showers on and south of the divide. Very little making it north of the divide, unfortunately. Slight risk of an afternoon thunderstorm about the eastern ranges. In terms of rainfall amounts today, we're looking at around 1 to 5 millimetres on and south of the divide, 5 to 10 millimetres, though, down around the south coast and the northeast ranges. We might see you know, some slightly higher totals in the thunderstorms about the eastern ranges this afternoon, but otherwise not terribly much of help for farmers north of the divide. And we will see the chance of some small hail about the south late into the evening as the coldest air moves to the south of us over Tasmania, but it doesn't really have much of an impact upon Victoria. Once again into tomorrow, southwesterly stream, it's an easing day. We will see showers on and south of the ranges, easing during the late afternoon and evening, but in terms of amounts, 1 to 5 millimetres is really the amounts there. I should mention for today, about the far south of the state and over the northeast ranges, quite a gusty day with the possibility of damaging winds about with gusts up to 90 kilometres an hour down about the southwest, the Otways, Bass Coast and the Strzelecki Ranges, and also over the northeastern ranges through the course of this afternoon. We have begun to see wind gusts pick up, and the strongest gusts that we've seen have been about the more exposed locations. So we've seen a gust up to 102 94 kilometres an hour about Wilson's Promontory and 80 kilometres an hour about the northeast ranges, but 81 kilometres an hour about Cape Nelson and Mount Gellibrand, also in the southwest. So gusty conditions for this afternoon and early evening about more exposed parts of Victoria. Into tomorrow, that easing southwesterly trend, as I said, some showers on and south of the ranges easing back 1 to 5 millimetres. Sunday's an important day for agricultural users, with a high-pressure system passing through Bass Strait to our south and quite a cold start, so a very cold air mass sitting over us, and the risk of frost on Sunday morning and also Monday morning as that high pressure system moves through Bass Strait and then out to the east. Otherwise dry days and quite pleasant. But warming up on Tuesday as a low pressure system approaches from South Australia, and we will see some showers and thunderstorms begin to push into the west on later on Tuesday, with some that low-pressure system then passing across the state on Wednesday and away to the southeast on Thursday. And we're looking at quite wet days on late Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday with thunderstorm risk and showers about. And quite high totals of rain, particularly about the northern country and northeast, where we're looking at 20 to 40 millimetres across late Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. Isolated 40 to 70 millimetres about the northeast highlands and the eastern ranges. 10 to 20 millimetres about the southwest and through the Wimmera. Unfortunately, only 2 to 10 millimetres about the Mallee and through central and Gippsland districts, looking at around 15 to 30 millimetres across those days. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are looking quite wet about large parts of the state. But really, it's the frost on Sunday and Monday that the farmers also should be aware of.
Can you tell us a little bit about those frost sort of outlooks and when and where and how long it's likely to hit?
Look, The frost is possible really over much of the state on Sunday in particular. That's going to be the coldest day with the lightest winds. And really the only parts of the state that I think that won't see frost will be either in the far northwest corner around Mildura, or down around the coastal locations where the onshore flow will probably just keep the temperatures just that little bit warmer. But any other location inland could see the some frost form. But I particularly think the Wimmera, the northern country and the northeast might be candidates for some severe frost on with temperatures getting down to around -2 on Sunday morning. That'll be determined tomorrow as to whether it will be quite that cold, but I think there's potential for it.
Oh, dear. I suppose not what many grain growers want to hear, but they need to know the information anyway. I suppose just quickly, before we let you go, Matthew, into next week, is there anything to keep an eye on weather-wise, you know, throughout the week?
Look, Wednesday is probably the most significant day because that's when the bulk of that rainfall that I mentioned will fall, particularly over the northern country and the northeast. But Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, with the thunderstorms and the showers and those reasonable falls of around 20 to 40 millimetres through the northern country and the northeast of the state. Are probably the most significant days, easing back on Friday as the low pressure system moves away and the rainfall amounts drop off considerably.
No worries, Matthew. Thank you very much for that update. Really appreciate it.
Okay, have a good day. Bye.
Matthew Thomas there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau, giving us the full update really on what to expect and also with that frost coming Sunday, Monday. If you are a grain grower, you can let us know how you're feeling about that now. But more importantly, we'd love the report on Monday, how it goes. If it's good, that's great. We want to hear about it. If it's bad, we also want to hear about it, but we know that can be tough too. Get in touch with the program on Monday and let us know how you fared with the frost coming through Sunday and Monday.
You're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
We're about to head to the Rural Muster. Before that, some of your photos have been coming in of how things are looking at the moment where you are. South of Rotchi, it's okay now, but we need a week's rain. Is that what you say? Next week's rain, sorry, is what Mick's saying. And yeah, the crop, it doesn't look like Margot's at Nering, looks significantly drier than that at Rotchi. Mick, thank you very much for sending that through. I was saying it's beautiful and warm. I am in Shepparton. This one says it's bloody cold and windy at Poowong. Sorry about that. And Steve at Kirwa says, hi, Warwick. Remaining fine and warm in the northwest, 25 degrees here today. Great to hear from you, Steve. Thank you for that. Grading at Yalka, says another text. A photo at the back of the tractor or whatever you're driving there of the grading of a paddock. You see a lot of the dry dirt and big cloud of dust behind that. Suppose that's what you want, though. You'd get bogged if it was too wet, wouldn't you? But looks like you're working hard today. Thanks for sending that through. And cutting oat and hay near Ultima. Too dry to push out ahead, says that text. Beautiful photo, but I suppose you're probably hoping for better conditions. Thank you for sending that through anyway. And Tom from Bendigo noted, thank you for sending that through as well. Every week on the Country Hour, we have a lot of stories we can't bring you all of that we'd like to bring you some of to take you around Australia to hear of what's happening around our great country in terms of agriculture. We call it the Rural Muster. Angus Verley, who's been in charge of the Country Hour this week, has the muster for you today. Take it away, Angus.
Thanks, Woz. We start today in Queensland, where a bid to create a label that would identify which milk was giving dairy farmers a fair go on prices has been scrapped. The Queensland Dairy Farmers Organisation's Fair Go logo was approved by the ACCC to help consumers identify dairy processors and brands paying their farmers a sustainable price. But the Australian Dairy Products Federation, which represents the country's major milk processors, blocked it by lodging an appeal with the Australian Competition Tribunal. QDO President Brian Tessman says the group has made the difficult decision not to fight the challenge.
That challenge, of course, would have meant a court basically doing the whole job again of what we went through with the ACCC and the ACCC only being on the sidelines providing information, and the cost of that, even to mount a minimal defence of it, was going to be completely prohibitive for basically a small organisation like the QDO.
A New South Wales parliamentary inquiry into floodplain harvesting is underway, with hearings being held via video conference. It's looking into the legality of floodplain harvesting and how the practice could be licensed. Macquarie River Food and Fibre Chairman Tony Quigley spoke at the hearing and says licensing the practice is long overdue.
This is the final piece of the jigsaw puzzle that we've been playing for over 20 years in water reform. And I think it's about time it was resolved to give everybody certainty, not only irrigators, but the environment, get all the rules set. And I'm sure everyone then will be happy to abide by them. But it's, as an irrigator and a person who's been involved in the water industry for a long time, this is becoming very frustrating that it's taking so long for all government to allow this to happen.
The Australian export hay industry is hoping emerging fodder markets in Southeast Asia could develop enough in the next few years to take all hay that otherwise would have gone to China. Australia was exporting about 350,000 tonnes of fodder to China, but in April, the Chinese government did not renew most Australian hay exporters' export licences. Belco's Pat Guerin says despite the loss, he's positive about the future of Australia's hay exports.
Obviously, there's going to be a development stage there, but I would be not surprised to see equivalent volumes that we've been moving into that Chinese market going into Southeast Asian markets over the next 2 to 3 years.
A pole Dorset ram from Tasmania has broken the breed record after fetching $41,000. The online sale took place through Auctions Plus, with Canala Stud near Canoundra and Garama Stud near Harden taking home the record-setting animal. Lachlan Patterson from Canala Pole Dorset Stud says they had their sights on acquiring the ram to keep developing their business.
If we didn't secure him, there wasn't really many other rams around that would kind of keep our genetic gain going in the right direction. So the ram's in the top 5% of Australia for growth at 200 days and also muscle at 200 days, and he's also got exceptional eating quality. So marbling's becoming a lot more important, and we're just looking at making sure that our sheep have got the right eating quality and performance data that kind of will be suit our clients into the future.
And staying on ram pricing, the Collinsville Stud near Hallett in South Australia has smashed the Australian on-property merino sale record. The stud sold 250 rams at its latest on-property sale, but the star was one ram that sold for $88,000, breaking the previous record by $7,000. Collinsville Stud Principal George Millington says it's a sign of the strength of the Australian sheep industry.
The sheep industry is actually travelling along pretty well. We're seeing near record prices for lambs. We're seeing record prices for mutton at this time of the year. And I think that's being translated in the fact that some farmers out there are actually probably maybe swinging a little bit out of some cropping paddocks and trying to run a few more sheep because they can see it's a viable thing for their enterprise.
And finally, Woz, do you eat the flowers they put on your restaurant plate? A Queensland farmer has switched from growing tomatoes to flowers as demand for edible flowers grows. Damien Hughes says colourful blooms are making their way onto restaurant plates across the country, and it's all about aesthetics.
It's not so much about the taste, it's more about the visual impact of the particular flower and their ability to be able to enhance what they've been what they're decorating, basically.
Well, there you go. More proof of the old adage, we eat with our eyes. Back to you, Oz.
It's a whole body experience for me, Angus. Thank you very much. Angus Verley there with the Rural Muster. If it's on my plate, I'm likely to eat it. It's 11 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Let's continue some of the rural news now with a look at dairy. A new report out has run the magnifying glass over the dairy processing sector, finding it contributes $12 billion towards Australia's GDP. The report was commissioned by the Australian Dairy Products Federation and produced by Deloitte Access Economics. The Federation says it's the first time there's been such a detailed look at the processing sector, and its president, Grant Carruthers, told Peter Somerville it comes at a time when margins are extremely tight.
It's an important ag sector that's seen dramatic change in the last 5 years, but also the last 20 years, where we've moved from a cooperative-centric industry to one of private capital and also an Australian hero in a listed entity. So it's been a lot of restructuring, and we thought it was high time that we examined exactly what the industry does do for the economy and for ag.
Yeah, so why do this? Is it because you want to quantify that change? Why invest in preparing this report?
Well, it's never been done before, and it's nice to clarify the value add that dairy processing provides. We have a unique symbiotic relationship with dairy farming, and we survive and prosper in the same ecosystem. And it's high time that the sector, as heavy investors in ag, is carved out and just understood a lot more.
What have you found here? What are some of the key findings?
Look, there's some really interesting data here, Peter. You know, you've got assets under management north of $6 billion. You've got an industry that employs 70,000 full-time equivalent jobs. 20,000 of these are direct and another 50,000 are indirect. So for every job, direct job in dairy processing, it supports 2.4 indirect positions in other activities, and this may be transport, ingredients, utilities, engineering, maintenance, et cetera, et cetera. And the other significant point is it's a regional hero. You've got over 50% of the jobs are generated in the regions. In Victoria, 58% of jobs in the dairy processing sector are in the regions or in regional Victoria, and in Tasmania it's 95%. So you've got an industry that for some is out of sight, out of mind, but it's very much a regional hero.
How are you going to use this data and this information into the future?
It's an insight for observers of the industry, and there are many. Particularly in the political hemisphere, it's very easy to get lost in the general ag industry. And we see that adding value to milk, preserving milk, and marketing it domestically and all around the world is a pretty unique skill set that the dairy processing sector has, and it's driven it into the regions and particularly Victoria. Victoria is obviously a hero for dairy, producing north of 60% of the nation's milk. And it's really important that the political world understands its value and its potential.
In building a case like this for an industry, I'm sure you've come across some numbers that flow into this. It's probably fair to say there's some parallels between dairy and the beef industry at the moment. Cattle prices are high, supplies short. We know processor margins are being squeezed as a result. Just how tight are things for dairy processors at the moment?
Oh, I think the word extremely comes to mind. You know, it's a very elevated milk price. It's a very competitive world in sourcing milk, and it remains a competitive world in selling milk. We have got very, very good import competition. You've also got the COVID impact, and COVID has affected everyone, including the processing sector, with the food service industry being absolutely smashed. So, you know, there's adjustment there.
Yeah, in this work with Deloitte, you've built a view of where the industry's at, but maybe tying in with the last point, where is it headed? We've seen job cuts at Tatura. Could we see more? Are things going to get even tighter?
It's all about value adding, and the industry's in very good shape. It's got well-capitalised companies who are reinvesting $130 million a year in their assets and investing north of $12 million a year in R&D. So the industry is not asleep. It's very active, and it's determined to continue on this world competitive path.
That's Grant Crothers, President of the Australian Dairy Products Federation, speaking there with Peter Somerville. You're listening to the Country Hour, and because it's Friday and because we've had a lot going on this week, haven't we? Certainly in terms of news. I'm not talking about the Country Hour here. I'm just talking about life in Victoria. Let's have some feel-good stories for you. Well, at least one. I wonder if you remember the story about Gordon Homewood, the ear tag collector. Now, Gordon is 5. He lives with his family on Wandanong Station near Mount Magnet in Western Australia, and he wanted to create an ear tag collection of 2 100s, or 200s, those playing at home. We met Gordon a bit over a month ago, I reckon, and when word got out what he was doing, collecting ear tags, the bush community across Australia responded in droves. And for an update, Joe Prendergast caught up with Gordon and his mum, Lara Jensen.
So, Gordon, how many tags have you got in your collection now?
462.
462
cattle tags.
Wow, 462 cattle tags. Gordon, what about sheep tags? Have you got any of them?
Yeah, 120.
We've got 120 total, which is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gordon, what's it been like when all of these parcels have been turning up in the mail for you?
I feel happy because those people are being so nice.
When I came and saw you a couple of months ago, Gordon, you told me that you were hoping to get 2 100s of tags. You've now got almost 600. You've got well over 500 tags. Is there room for any more in your collection?
Well, yeah.
You're still chasing more, are you?
Yeah, I want 555.
Yeah, that's a pretty good number, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where have these tags?
Or maybe more.
Maybe more? Are you able to count them all? It's a pretty big number.
Yeah, I can count up to 500.
We've counted them a few times now, the collection, haven't we?
Yeah.
Hey, Gordon, can you tell me about any of the places that some of these tags have been coming from?
Mel was, because Mary and David were there.
Yanwi,
because Colby was there. Yeah. And Rocky for Coribon, because he was a very good job on Outback Winger, and he's very good at catching balls.
Yeah, Lockie McClimate's mum and dad, and Lockie sent us a tag, and Gordon loves that one. And where else do they come from, mate? What other states?
Queensland, and I have one from Ireland and Canada.
Did you get one from Canada?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Tell me about that one. What colour is it, Gordon?
Red.
Gordon, what are you going to do with all of these tags? What's the plan?
Going to make a special draw for them, like my friend Russell, because he sent me lots of tags. Half of his collection, which was a box, and then he got me another box. Russell is a good man because he's been collecting ear tags too, just like me.
Yeah, and he's a bit older than you though, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you like to say to those people who might be listening to us and have sent you some tags?
Thank you very much.
It's beautiful to see his little dream come true. It's been absolutely amazing. These tags have literally come from hell, Western Crooked. They've come from every state. And most people have sent a lovely letter just telling Gordon something about their operation, you know, whether it's cattle or sheep or cropping, and a bit about themselves, which has been really beautiful. So it's a really lovely thing that people out there want to encourage kids into agriculture and support them with it. It's been really lovely.
That is Lara Jensen and her son Gordon speaking to Joe Prendergast. If you're interested in reading more, and if you just want to read a good news story after everything we've had over the last week, head online, abc.net.au/rural, or just search Gordon and EarTag, or ABC and EarTag or something. You'll see his impressive and growing EarTag collection for yourself. Hopefully he'll get to his next goal past the 550 tags. Maybe more. If you do want, someone's already sent a text on how to get in touch. Go online, read the story, work it out from there. Gordon Homewood is his name, and he's a very passionate EarTag collector. I hope you have a great weekend. Hope that's put you in the right step for it. We'll catch you on Monday.